move to the fifth case for today, which is Ron Belda versus Marilyn Marshall.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is John Alcamitas. At the debtor appellant's table is also my partner James Demiz, who may be assisting me in this matter. Before I begin, if I may just please ask the court to please speak into the microphone, because I am hearing impaired and I do have a hard time hearing. If you can just speak into the microphone, it would be easier for me to understand your questions or comments and so on.
Don't be afraid to tell us if you can't hear us either.
Thank you, Your Honor. What brings us here today is the debtor appellant, filed a Chapter 13 on May 20th of 2003.
Could I ask you, though, whether anything is, in fact, before us? Because as I understand, the Chapter 13 that he originally filed has since been dismissed, and no appeal was taken from that order of dismissal. I believe we asked the parties to be prepared to discuss this problem, because if that case is gone, then what order could we possibly enter that would make any difference?
It wouldn't have a direct impact on this case because it really doesn't exist anymore, but it would have a significant legal impact as to how unsecured debts are treated under Section 1322b5.
But as you know, I'd be happy to write a law review article about that too, but we can't issue advisory opinions. It's an interesting question, in fact, but is it properly before us as a court in this case?
Your Honor, the issue is technically moot. However, the court should hear this issue because two elements have to be met, almost an exception to the mootness doctrine. One is that the litigation was concluded prior to the court having an opportunity to hear the matter, which it did because the case was dismissed in November of last year. And two, the same issue is capable of repeating itself.
But you know, in this case, though, first of all, this isn't really much like pregnancy. Pregnancies last 9 months, and I'm referring to pregnancy only because the capable of repetition yet evading review rationale has been used in quite a few abortion cases. Pregnancies end, and that's that. Whereas in this case, as I understand, in Mr. Belda's new Chapter 13 plan, he's proposing to pay all of his creditors 100% of their claims. And so, oddly enough, we seem to know it didn't repeat in this case. The issue about creating categories and fairness to unsecured creditors and how we're supposed to read this provision for long-term debt, it's not here anymore.
Your Honor, in the subsequent case, the reason the debtor proposed to pay his unsecured creditors at the same level or pay him the same dividend as other unsecured creditors was precisely because of this case. The same thing would have happened again. The trustee would have objected to a similar plan. Judge Doyle or the bankruptcy judge would have...
Well, but with good reason. If he's capable of paying, unless this is a bad faith offer, if he's capable of paying 100% of the claim in a Chapter 13, then that's what he should pay. That's the idea of Chapter 13.
And following up on Judge Woods, by Mr. Belda's own admission, this situation only arose because he failed to stay the action in the bankruptcy court. In other words, the issue itself doesn't inherently evade review. And that's, you know, that's that American Horse Protective Association case, which is a Ninth Circuit case, but what the Ninth Circuit said is where prompt application for a stay pending appeal can preserve an issue for appeal, the issue is not one that will evade review.
Well, had the debtor proposed in the subsequent Chapter 13 what he proposed in his first Chapter 13, we would be having the same argument here today, just 2 years from now. The exact same issue would have happened. We would have assuming that the debtor, now, Chapter 13s get dismissed for various reasons. Change in economic circumstances to the debtor, lost jobs, illness, and so on. If you fall behind on your payments on your Chapter 13 trustee, creditors of the trustee will file a motion to dismiss, and the overwhelming majority of Chapter 13s are ultimately dismissed.
Now, Mr. Yakimidis, I have to say that as it happens, we're all going to become experts in Chapter 13 going forward, given the statutory change that has just been enacted. But nice as it would be to get a ruling, shouldn't we just wait for that hypothetical 2 years from now appeal? For all we know, as you're just saying, it may never happen. Maybe everybody will resolve everything without the need for an appeal.
Your Honor, all I can say at this point, the debtor was forced to follow a course of action or a certain under 13 section 1322b5 in a subsequent case because he would expect to receive the same treatment or the same objection from the trustee's office, and this issue would be again before this court again.
Okay. I mean, if that's your response, then yeah, that's fine.
That's my response to that. I just
okay.
Because cases get dismissed, and we can never get to a hearing to actually determine what the law is in terms of for the Seventh Circuit, at least.
I mean, it's so interesting because a district court would have no authority to dismiss a case pending appeal to our court. But you know that Fifth Circuit case in Ray Manges is kind of interesting. Oh well.
Okay.
Well, it is inconsistent with normal judicial procedure for a lower court to be able to dismiss a case while a case is on appeal. I mean, that's just the fact of the matter. I know both sides agree they can do it.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the interesting thing with Chapter 13s are is you have one debtor and you have various different parties that are really part of the litigation. It may take a year and a half to get to the case to the Court of Appeals. If the bankruptcy court did not retain jurisdiction to dismiss that case, all the rights of other creditors would be affected. If payments aren't being made in the plan, car lien holders are not getting paid, mortgage companies are not getting paid. Well, we can't put all those interests at bay and wait 2 years for a court of appeals hearing or determination of the issue. So, I think the bankruptcy court.
Well, there's a little difference between an interlocutory appeal while the case remains pending in that court and a dismissal of the case. I mean, that's really the more confusing thing about it, seems to me.
Okay.
I understand that your position and the trustee's position, but are there any cases which address that question about dismissal while a case is on appeal?
Your Honor, all I can refer to is, not that I know of specifically, all I can refer to is under Bankruptcy Rule 8005, that the debtor can bring a motion to stay pending appeal. That wasn't done in this case.
No, I understand that. I mean, that's
intentionally, but that was not done in this case. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. I guess real quickly, because I see my white light has come up, but real quickly, if I could just kind of have the court look at the argument from a in terms of a framework, what Section 1322b5 does, that specifically deals with long-term debt. It specifically provides that a debtor may continue the maintenance of payments to unsecured and secured claims so long as those payments on those claims, the last payment is due after the completion of the debtor's Chapter 13 plan. The classification of the debt, whether it's secured, unsecured, or dischargeable or not dischargeable, really is not relevant. But what Congress really intended here is we have a long-term debt provision under Section 1322b5 specifically for long-term debts. It is a free and standing entitlement, just like the bankruptcy court said. If we give it this clear meaning, specifically what it says, this court should give it its full effect. I mean, we can try to make arguments to try to define it differently, but let's define it with what it actually says, secured and unsecured debts. And one quick point, this section is used by mortgage debtors all the time to cure mortgage arrears and to continue making mortgage payments during the pendency of a Chapter 13. Because it's a secured debt under 1322b-5, but the word says in there secured and unsecured debts. The trustee has never filed an objection to a debtor's case where the debtor proposed to continue making regular mortgage payments under 1322b-5 and say, well, it violates 1322b-1 as to other secured creditors like car companies. Either it's going to apply to everyone or it's going to apply to no one. So I would just ask the court to follow the bankruptcy court's reasoning that it's the 1322b-1 and b-5 are freestanding entitlements. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My esteemed colleague, Mr. Iokamidis, may it please the court.
That's such a nice way to begin.
Thank you. My name is Jay Tribo. I represent the Chapter 13 trustee, Marilyn O. Marshall, the appellee in this case. I guess the first thing I'd like to address is that, as Your Honors have recognized, there is some question regarding the effect of the dismissal.
Counsel, just a minute. If you would pull your chair up towards the end of the table here, you may.
Your Honors have some question about the impact of the dismissal of the underlying bankruptcy case.
I'm wondering why you moved to dismiss the underlying case while the appeal was still pending.
Because, as counsel indicates, Chapter 13 case involves a number of different parties. All of their rights are impacted. The debtor was not performing in any way under the plan. Section 1326 of the Bankruptcy Code requires a debtor to continue to make payments, but payments were not being made. All the creditors in the case were still subject to the effect of the automatic stay, but their rights were in no way being protected in that bankruptcy case.
Do you have any citations for the proposition that the bankruptcy court retains jurisdiction to dismiss a case while it's pending on appeal? You cited a case in your brief for the proposition that a bankruptcy court may stay dismissal of the underlying case, but you don't cite any cases allowing the bankruptcy court to dismiss the underlying case. And you guys are driving me crazy.
I apologize for that, Judge. I have not cited any case in my brief. Like counsel for the appellant, we would certainly prefer that the court reach the substantive issues. We believe that those are important substantive issues and that this court should reach them on the merits. Whether they, in fact, can or not is a separate issue. This court itself has, in fact, ruled in one case in the matter of Statistical Tabulating Corp., Inc., 60F 3rd 1286, that a lower court, a bankruptcy court, does in fact retain jurisdiction. That one was a little bit different in that the issue there was the case went up on appeal, and then it was whether the bankruptcy court had jurisdiction to reopen the case and do what the higher court instructed it to do on remand.
And could the bankruptcy court have sua sponte stayed Belda's case until the appeal was resolved?
I don't believe that a bankruptcy court has authority to sua sponte stay the bankruptcy pending an appeal. I think that's specifically provided for in the rules, in Rule 8006, I believe it is, or 8005, and that the party seeking the appeal has to move for that stay.
Ask you this. I mean, I have the feeling, actually, that we may a little bit be talking about apples and oranges here, because rules of finality for appeal for a 28 U.S.C. Section 158D appeal to the Court of Appeals are a little peculiar in bankruptcy cases, because if a bankruptcy case before the bankruptcy court is thought of as a multi-party proceeding where you have the debtor, you have a trustee, and you have, you know, creditors A through N, that's the bankruptcy proceeding. And then there could be a final judgment between the debtor and creditor A, which would qualify under 28 U.S.C. Section 158D as a judgment that could get all the way up to the Court of Appeals. The rules for getting to the Court of Appeals are somewhat different from the rules for getting from the bankruptcy court to the district court. And what we have is that, you know, case involving just the debtor and one of the creditors, and it's the underlying whole thing. It's not actually the same proceeding, in a sense, that got dismissed, as I understand it. It was the whole bankruptcy. It was the whole Chapter 13,
the
right?
whole bankruptcy did get dismissed.
So a bigger thing got dismissed at the bankruptcy level than was pending before this court.
That's correct. And the case that I referenced did deal with the discrete issue between two creditors. So it was it's distinct and it distinguishable from this case.
But isn't what was
subsumed?
Isn't this subsumed in the entire dismissal?
This issue?
I think the question Judge Rovner is asking is, if there's an appeal as to one part of the bankruptcy proceeding that has finally satisfied the requirements of 158D, does that preclude action with respect to the rest of the bankruptcy, the whole bankruptcy proceeding as a whole, or does the bankruptcy judge have to wait until all of those appeals are resolved before dismissing the entire bankruptcy?
Can I rephrase that? Is the question that because this appeal arose out of the confirmation of the case, which affected the entire case, does that mean that the court couldn't do anything, the bankruptcy court couldn't do anything while these appeals were pending? Is that
I guess what I was thinking of it is, you'll see, whether it's core or non-core proceedings, you'll see pieces of the bankruptcy become final enough for appeal. And does the fact that one of those pieces of the bankruptcy can be appealed, is that something which then feeds back into the authority of the bankruptcy court to decide, for example, let's say that a Chapter 13 or a Chapter 7 was brought in bad faith, or, you know, any number of things that a bankruptcy court might do which would result in the dismissal of the entire proceeding?
Well, I certainly don't believe that the appeal of a discrete issue, whether it's a core or non-core matter, precludes the bankruptcy judge from taking action with respect to other parties' rights in the continuing impending bankruptcy case.
Even though the entire thing has been dismissed, it's not on that docket anymore.
Well, I'm talking about before it's dismissed, while the appeal is pending.
Well, it would be like an interlocutory appeal that doesn't preclude, for example, the district court from taking other action on if it's going up on one particular issue.
Right.
Right. But this certainly, in trustee's position, was in no way an interlocutory appeal.
Right. No, I understand that, but I'm trying to compare to the question that Judge Wood was asking. Well, the fact of the matter is, it seems to me, if we're not going to issue an advisory opinion, we have to declare that the bankruptcy judge erred in dismissing the case. Otherwise, there's no pending matter.
Well, I...
But there's no appeal from the order of dismissal.
There isn't. It's been final a long time. It's never been... There's been no appeal ever perfected
from
that. Well,
then you're working yourself into a position where we'd be issued an advisory opinion, which we can't do.
Which...
Well, you'd be happy.
I'm here before you, I'm prepared to make an argument with respect to the substantive issues. I don't necessarily disagree with the court that there may be nothing to decide, but I'm here. I'd like to at least very briefly, if I may, make a couple of statements regarding the substantive issues. One is that I'd like to clarify something with respect to what counsel said. He raised an issue about the trustee not ever objecting when a mortgage creditor uses Section 1322b-5 to pay its long-term debt as somehow violating the unfair discrimination provision of 1322b-1. The reason we never do is because 1322b-1 applies only to unsecured creditors, only to classes of unsecured claims. It doesn't apply. There's no unfair discrimination restriction with respect to secured creditors, period. The other thing I'd like to point out is that the doctrine of inclusio unius exclusio alterius, that, you know, where the inclusion of one is the exclusion of the other, applies to these statutes and the interaction of 1322. The interaction of 1322b1 with respect to 1322b5, as well as the interaction of 1322b5 with section 1322b2. They relate to each other and exclude various provisions amongst each other, and therefore the fact that it doesn't exclude the application of unfair discrimination to the long-term debt provision would indicate that it does apply. In addition, Judge, Your Honors, y'all made a point that the debtors have filed a new case. They're paying 100% to their unsecured creditors, including the student loan creditors. That case has been confirmed. The debtor is performing perfectly under that plan. And one of the considerations of whether discrimination is necessary is fair or unfair, is whether it's necessary. Clearly, it's not necessary. They've shown it themselves.
Counsel, thank you. Your time has expired.
Thank you very much.
Your time has expired, but I'll give you a minute.
Chapter 13s are really peculiar kind of cases, and I'm not sure that I understand that the court cannot issue an advisory opinion. There's got to be an actual case in controversy. Chapter 13s are peculiar cases. Really, they're district court cases. It's only through the authority of the district court, the bankruptcy court has actually even existed, able to hear cases. So we can't. It's almost in terms of giving it a mootness review as to whether there would be repetition and so on, it's not a normal case, especially if the court takes into consideration as a practical matter that the majority, I think over 70% of Chapter 13s, are ultimately dismissed before they reach completion. These issues always come up. Cases get dismissed for a variety of reasons. We'll never get to a Court of Appeals Seventh Circuit decision. I don't know how long it would take, because these Chapter 13s ultimately get dismissed, most of them, except over 70% get dismissed. The practical considerations, I think, may require just a different kind of review in terms of mootness. It doesn't come straight from the district court. We have an intermediate court being the district court, which creates just gives it a long time before we could actually get a decision on the case. What happens if it was a 6-month plan or a 9-month plan? It would never even get here. The debtor would have completed the plan. And on the subsequent case, there is a change in economic circumstance that the debtor proposed 100% and also proposed 100%, because we know in advance we would get an objection, as on this case. We would just repeat the whole process all over again.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. Case will be taken under advisement.